What's going on, everyone? Back with another episode of the Dropping Knowledge Podcast. And for those of you who are not watching, I'm currently sitting in an airplane hangar outside of Reno, Nevada. And I'm sitting here with a buddy of mine who a lot of you guys don't know that we've kind of been friends for 3 years now. You are kind of a homesteader, family man. You got some dogs, you got chickens. And most people know you as a pilot here with Trent Palmer.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having me, because we're sitting literally in your hangar right now.
Yeah, it's so funny. I think I told you I've been trying to start a podcast for like 5 years.
And you recorded the first episode a couple times? A
couple times, and then I'm just not happy with it, and I've been like, I just need the space. And then I'm like, well, I have the space.
Now, man, if only there was space somewhere around here.
If I had room.
Yeah, if you guys are not watching this podcast, I would recommend it. At least just tune in, see what it looks like, because we're sitting in Trent's hangar at his house. His house is over stage left, and he has a runway in front of us. Obviously, his plane, Freedom Fox, Kit Fox behind us, and there's plenty of room. I've got my Tacoma and Kimbo in here as well. So,
yeah.
You told me that you fit about 5 bush planes in here before?
Yeah, so 5 of the, like, a plane's my size.
Okay, so all, like, Kit Fox or Cubs or whatever.
Cubs have a bigger wingspan, so they eat up a little bit more space in a hangar. So
okay.
More Kit Fox. Highlander's another competitor.
We can jump right into the nerdy plane stuff, but isn't your wingspan bigger than a normal Kit Fox?
So, no. It's the same wingspan, but the wing is larger. It's just the chord of it. So, from the leading edge to trailing edge is longer.
Okay.
And it's a thicker profile, and it's got a different lift profile. So,
more lift,
square footage-wise, it has a larger wing. It's just not wider. But yes, definitely more lift, specifically at low speeds.
Okay. Well, yeah. Cool. So I always like to start this by kind of talking to you like it's the first time I'm talking to you. But give people a rundown of what got you into flying. Also, people who don't know, maybe who don't know you at all, have never seen your plane. Again, check out the video version of this. But it's essentially a tailwheel plane, experimental, and that's about the extent of what I know about flying. Like, everything that I know about aviation basically came from you, so.
Oh, don't trust a word you heard, then. You know nothing.
You know, I don't know shit.
Yeah.
I mean, if it came from you, no.
Yeah.
So, yeah, let's start with, like, what got you into flying? Was it a thing when you were a kid? You just looked up, and you're like, man, I want to do that someday.
So, weirdly, in a way, yes. I grew up always loving aviation. I made my parents pay for the Discovery Flight Channel, and I was a kid that could fold every paper airplane out there. Super into it. Got into RC planes when I was little, but deathly terrified of flying and heights.
Huh.
So I enjoyed flying from the ground. So, like, RC stuff was my thing.
Okay.
And so grew up in a little ski town. In doing that, I started making ski movies.
Like Warren Miller style?
Kind of, not that well produced. And we were just park rats, like, I mean, grinding rails and getting in trouble and stuff. But one of the pinnacles of making it in the ski film industry was, like, you film from a helicopter. So that was my dream.
Okay.
And I could never afford that. So what I ended up doing was building a radio control helicopter and putting a camera on the front. It's like my poor man's version of it.
Okay. I see where this is going.
Yep. And so I built one, and it was just for fun to shoot my little stuff. And then I went out and shot a demo with a friend that's a pro mountain biker. And we posted it online. This is like Vimeo days.
Okay.
And it got like 100,000 views or something in like a month.
It's big on Vimeo, especially that long ago.
Yeah. So the phone started ringing, and basically I all of a sudden was getting hired to go fly this RC helicopter with a camera on the front. And mind you, this is before drones.
Yeah. Right? I was going to ask, what year roughly is this?
This was early 2010.
So this is well before, like, the DJI Phantom and, like, the big white drones that everyone started with.
Yeah. So back then, DJI, at least in their early days, they used to make autopilot units for single rotor RC helicopters.
Okay.
But they were notoriously, like, finicky, and no one really liked using them.
Kind of like a lot of their stuff still today.
Well, early stuff for sure. They've come a really long ways. But so before I knew it, I basically had this new job flying, unmanned aircraft in the film industry.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a Remodernization Act of the FAA's regulations. I think it was in 2012, but they didn't really start enforcing it until 2014.
Okay.
And basically that stated anyone that flies any aircraft commercially has to have a pilot certificate.
And that's when they implemented the Part 107, I guess.
This is before that.
Oh, so, even before.
Yeah, it was the Section 333 exemption. So basically you had to request an exemption from the regulations that stated that basically every pilot has to be within reach of the flight controls in their aircraft All this stuff that only pertains to manned aircraft.
This is all UAV stuff then. Uh-huh. Okay.
But the requirement, they still required that we got our pilot's license. So I was forced into it for work that I had to go out and get my pilot's license.
See, I'm glad I asked that because I legit didn't know that
part.
Oh,
you didn't?
Like, no, yeah. I knew about your business and Copter Kids and stuff like that, but I didn't know that was a progression. So
yeah.
At that time, without, like, anyone can go and get a Part 107 nowadays.
Oh, it's a written test. Yeah, it's easy.
Yeah. But so back then, you actually had to go learn how to fly a plane?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you had to have a minimum of a private pilot certificate. So the good thing was they didn't require a commercial certificate, which would be a lot more hours and training. But basically, yeah, that forced me into the cockpit. And I cannot overstate how scared of flying I was. Like, this was a means to an end. I was like, I will never fly again once I get my license. I just want to be able to continue work so I can put food on the table.
Yeah. How many hours was the requirement at the time?
40. Yep.
Okay.
So, and that's still what it is. And I think the average, most people go through it around 60 hours to check ride.
Okay.
I took it at 41, right there, but
it's like, get me out of this freaking plane.
Dude, and the first, I just remember being like I would pick my nicest underwear to go flying because if my wife had to come identify my body, I wanted to at least be wearing nice stuff. Like, I was like fairly confident I was going to die in an airplane.
Dang.
Like,
okay.
As a kid too, I used to have repeating nightmares of crashing in an airplane, but it was always in the back of like an airliner.
This is before you're even flying. It's just like commercial flight. You watch a lot of Castaway as a kid.
Yeah. Watched all the wrong shows and movies,
but
so it was an interesting shift, but like I would say around 20 hours, it started to click of like my flight training that I'm like, oh, hold on. I'm starting to get the hang of this. And by check ride, I was like, dude, this is the best thing ever. And I'm like, what plane, like, how do I continue to fly? So
it only took 40 hours for you to completely turn yourself around to be like, I want to do this for the rest of my life.
Yeah. And so that's when I kind of hit this point where I'm like, so how do I continue? I can't afford like a really high end, nice plane. So I was like, I need to find something that I can either rent or buy that I can afford to continue to fly.
Right.
But rentals, it's like most airplane that you rent, you know, 120 would be a cheap per hour rate for a plane. But if you want to fly regularly, that's not that easily doable. You'll burn through a lot of cash quick.
And I'm assuming, you correct me when I'm wrong, but I'm assuming they're like tri-wheel planes. They're not tailwheels.
Yeah, nose wheel. Yeah.
Nose wheel, like Cessnas and things like that. Okay.
Yep. And so I kind of was looking at like this six seater, a Cherokee 6 is what it's called. It's made by Piper.
Okay.
My thought was I could use that to fly my guys and my gear to jobs.
Mm-hmm.
But then the more I started thinking about it, I'm like, then I have this pressure to get there that I have to get somewhere. And that's just going to push me into bad weather. And that's how people die.
Those
planes are pretty expensive and way more expensive to run and maintain. So a buddy of mine was like, you should look at a Kit Fox. And at the time, there wasn't much out there that I could find on Kit Foxes. All I could find was these old VHS tapes that someone had converted and put on YouTube, like from the 80s or 90s. Like, the early Kit Foxes were basically ultralights. They had a two-stroke engine on the front, which was basically a converted snowmobile engine.
Yeah.
And they were super lightweight. They built them. I mean, they still do all have folding wings. So the wings can fold back so you can throw it on a trailer and tow it home and put it in your garage.
That's so rad.
Yeah. So at first, I was like, I don't want one of those. That looks like a death trap and a toy. But I looked into it more and I started thinking about it. I'm like, well, that actually seems like, you know, something I can afford, and not only afford to buy, but afford to continue to fly and maintain. And so experimental, what you were talking about, that's a category of aircraft. Mine is an experimental amateur built. So it started as a kit.
Okay.
Some guy, John Johnson, back in 95 bought it and built it in his garage in Dallas, Texas, and did his own flight testing, and then it's an airplane, and effectively he is the manufacturer at that point.
Dang. So explain to people who don't, like, maybe they're just listening, they don't know what a Kit Fox looks like. Does it come in boxes and then like you put the frame together kind of like an Erector set?
Yeah. So basically you'll end up getting the fuselage, which is a welded chromoly fuselage. Mm-hmm. Looks like a
roll cage.
Like a roll cage, yeah, a chassis for like a race vehicle. Just thinner tubes, and it comes powder coated and all that. And then basically the builder's in charge of assembling all the flight controls, installing all the stuff from the seats to rudder pedals, all the cables, all the electronics and wiring, and then covering the fuselage with fabric because it's a tube and fabric airplane. And then paint and all that. So
I flew with you once before, probably like 2 years ago, 3 years ago, whenever it was. But last night I came over to your hangar and you were replacing a tail wheel, just doing like some mods and upgrades. And that was the first time I've seen even like a little bit of the plane with panels off. Yeah. And like peeking in the back there at the rudder and everything, I didn't realize how simplistic it really is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's literally sticks wrapped in, I don't know what kind of fabric the, like what's the shell made of?
It is, it's a fabric. I don't know what the
Almost feels like saran wrap.
It's actually a pretty strong fabric. Okay. So Kit Fox, they build this little demonstration, little square out of the fabric mm-hmm. that they take to Oshkosh. It's a big air show, expo type thing.
Yeah.
But you can like literally jump on it like a trampoline.
Really?
So okay. it's fairly strong once it's all like stretched over it. So basically you start by gluing this fabric on, and then there's multiple coats of things from the original filler that makes it to where air can't go through it. Right.
Okay.
So it takes it from a porous state to non-porous. And then you have like UV coatings, and then you go into top coats, which are color coats. So it's a process, but it's something they've been doing for like, you know, 100 years.
Yeah. So. It's crazy to think about, because if I'm just listening to this being described, it sounds like
sketchy. Well,
yeah, it sounds so sketchy.
Yeah.
But when you look at like especially your plane and like some of your buddies' planes that I've seen over the years, it's like, wow, these are like a lot of times kind of hand-built like works of art, like your buddy's plane that we flew with today.
Yeah.
He completely cut that thing apart, put it back together, and it's like, wow, you really understand like the craftsmanship that goes into it. So,
yeah.
Was yours a kit or was there a builder behind your plane originally?
Well, so it was a kit and the original person who bought it built it. So it wasn't like, so there are people that do like contract building. Like say you want a new Kit Fox and you buy the kit, you can hire someone to build it for you.
Okay.
This wasn't that. He was an owner builder.
So he already flown it and it was just selling the used plane then?
Yep. And I'm actually the third owner. I bought it from the guy that bought it from the builder.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's gone through quite an evolution since even I got it. The previous owner put different landing gear on it, put the bubble doors, the mm-hmm. clear doors that stick out farther. And then he did put slightly bigger tires and a few other things on it. And then I've pretty much, the only thing that's left of the plane I bought is the tail section.
Yeah, I mean, you've rehauled the whole thing. I mean, I remember looking at some of your earlier videos, didn't even look like the same plane, essentially.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's been cool. It's been quite the evolution. It's just like, it's my magic carpet to adventure, right?
Yeah.
So I drive it or fly it the way you would drive a Razor. Like it's out there just for fun. And again, you know, the thing burns 5 gallons an hour and I can run car gas. So you're kind of like, you know, 20, 25 bucks an hour to fly the thing. It's, you know, pretty dang cheap and I do all my own maintenance. So
that was one of the things that when we first started hanging out that I was like most surprised by, like, the entry level to get into something like a Kit Fox, it seems really expensive. Like aviation as a whole seems like it would be a very expensive hobby. But in reality, with a plane like this, it doesn't really have to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's all relative. It's still expensive, but there are affordable ways to do it. And it's kind of like if there's a will, there's a way. I think a lot of people assume anyone that has an airplane of their own is just rich.
Yeah.
And I can tell you for a fact that 90% of the guys I fly with are not what I would consider, you know,
they're just extreme rich. Hobbyists. That
yeah. I mean, you find a way. I mean, same with, you know, overlanding and off-road stuff. You can spend more than an airplane on that.
Yeah.
So yeah, my airplane when I bought it was 39 grand. So
that's, I mean, it's like buying a truck.
Yeah. My truck costs more than that.
Yeah. My truck when it was stock cost 41, I think. So
yeah.
And then you do some upgrades and stuff. My truck. So I guess that's a good segue into like what caused me to kind of find your channel. And like we just literally became friends over Instagram. I think I hit you up and I was like, hey, dude, you have no idea who I am, but I'm going to be in Reno next week if you want to like film something. And then you probably looked at my page and you were like, sure, dude, like you do adventure stuff.
Yeah.
And like I knew you were like, we're both very adventurous people, but with different modes of transportation. So I come out here and get to hang out with you and go fly and stuff like that. And it like, it makes my adventures feel so insignificant.
I don't know about that.
It's just like from my perspective, because it's a whole different world, but we're essentially accomplishing the same goals.
Yeah. Just getting out there. That is, yeah. It's funny that we're both going to say that, but you know, I've got I've got all the toys at this point. It feels like it seems silly. It's just that that corner of the hangar is what exemplifies it. I don't own a side by side anymore, but
yeah,
you know, I love getting outside and playing. And it was the flying was probably the most rewarding of the different hobbies I've ever been in my life. And it's, I think, one, it's like everyone has this kind of, you know, baseline urge to fly. We've all had dreams of that when you're younger. So yeah. That's something in there, but also like the freedom of it. Like our whole life is kind of constrained to these roads on a two-dimensional world. And as soon as you go up, you're like, I can go any direction I want.
Yeah. That's the coolest feeling. Like I have really only flown commercially. Once I started growing my YouTube channel, I had a bunch of opportunities to be in helicopters for some reason. Like people are like, oh, you want to go shoot machine guns out of a helicopter? I'm like, hell yeah, I want to do that. That was like one of the first times I was ever up in the air outside of commercial. We took a helicopter tour that my girlfriend bought me for my birthday from Vegas. And then we flew, landed into the bottom of the Grand Canyon and had lunch. It was cool.
Yeah.
And then I flew up and down the strip a bunch of times because a dude from Maverick Helicopters watches the channel. I think your plane is probably the only like non-commercial plane that I've probably ever been in.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. Cause honestly, prior to my flight training, I think I'd been in a small plane once.
Yeah.
Cause a friend of mine had a access to a plane.
Okay.
But it's not uncommon for me to hear that someone flies with me and they're like, this is the first time I've been in a small plane.
Yeah. I mean, so, it's a small plane.
Yeah.
Very small.
That's the funny thing too. I know the angles to make it look like impressive online, but it's still, I mean, we were talking about it. It's 900 pounds and that's a heavy kit Fox. Cause I got the big engine and all the fancy stuff in it.
Yeah.
But,
so you got a 4-cylinder boxer, opposed boxer with a turbocharger on there.
Yep. Boxer style. So horizontally opposed 4-cylinder.
Okay.
It's made by Rotax. Which BRP Motors, and they've been making aviation specific 4-stroke engines for 32 years. Mm-hmm. They kind of had a bad like rap at first because of the 2-stroke ones and people not knowing how to operate them right. But these, you know, the engine in my plane is probably the most technologically advanced internal combustion engine available in that industry. That's, you know, crazy. To go any higher, you're into a turbine, which, you know, jet engine,
yeah. So. I was in Moab sometime last year and I flew in a turbine helicopter for the first time, which is pretty cool.
Oh, your other ones weren't turbine?
I don't remember. No, they were. Yeah,
because yeah,
one was like a little bird, but it was, I forget what it was. It was like one of the lightest turbine engines out there.
Huh.
Does Rolls-Royce make a?
Yep.
Okay, that's what he was telling me about it. And like maybe I just didn't know about all the other birds that I flew in, but he told me about it and I was like, well, that's really interesting. Cause I like the engineering behind things.
Yeah.
Like seeing under the hood how stuff works. I actually just found out today that the Kit Fox sitting behind Trent actually weighs more than my Kimbo sitting on the back of my truck right now.
Yeah, your camper's a porker.
Yeah.
She wouldn't fly.
In the grand scheme of things, the Kimbo's relatively light. Dry with like how I have it set up, it weighs 980 pounds, whereas your plane weighs, you said, 940, 920?
It's like 928 or 930.
Okay.
Yeah, I got to look at the last
that's wild.
Weight and balance.
So you have obviously so many reasons why you love flying, but what are some of the downsides to it, if any?
Well, you're not going to get rich flying. There's a joke in the flying world that it's like, if you want to become a millionaire from flying, easy, start as a billionaire. It'll, okay. It'll get rid of some zeros pretty quick. So,
okay, good.
It, you know, even on the cheapest end of things, you know, anything aviation grade part wise is expensive. And, you know, owning an airplane and flying is more expensive than not owning an airplane and flying. So that's one downside. And then, I kind of interrupted you there.
No, you're good. I was thinking to go off of something like that, but are there people who learn how to fly and they think like, hey, this is a way for me to make money?
Yeah. I mean, I would like say the vast majority of people who get into like becoming a pilot is to go the commercial route and become an airline pilot.
Okay.
Yeah.
But like flying bush planes and stuff like that, like I thought you were going down the line of like people want to do tours and I don't know.
Well, I mean, there's absolutely commercial bush pilots. You know, in Alaska, they're flying, you know, hunting and fishing guys out to remote camps and flying supplies in and out of camps and all sorts of stuff like that. You know, there's large regions of the world in remote areas that depend on bush pilots.
Yeah, especially Alaska. Have you flown up there?
No, it's on my bucket list.
Have you been to Alaska?
Never been to Alaska.
I'm
scared to go.
I'm going this
probably,
June.
Like, want to move.
Yeah, dude. I mean, you live in a beautiful area. Like, you guys can't see, but we're looking out of his hangar right now. Just mountains all around, snow cap, sagebrush everywhere. It's beautiful land out here. How many landing spots have you claimed on your own out here? Because there's a lot of BLM land and public access land. You can kind of fly anywhere with your plane setup and just land wherever you're comfortable, right?
Yeah. It's probably one of the better places in the world to live to do that kind of stuff. You know, so Nevada, 85% of it's public land.
Yeah.
By ratio, that's more than Alaska, I believe, at least as far as the open usable. And again, we're just talking ratio wise because Alaska is much larger as far as the square mileage or, you know, the area of it. But
yeah, like 625 million or something.
Yeah.
Like that.
But also so much of Alaska is this hostile, like unpassable land. I mean, if you land an airplane there, you're sending a helicopter to get it out. It's,
jeez,
you know, you land anywhere once.
Yeah.
But out here, we have a lot of places you can take back off.
Speaking of that, we kind of went on a little mission today with your buddy who wrecked his plane,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to have a whole video out on this. It may be out by the time this podcast comes out. I'm not sure, but I filmed a little video of just hanging here, flying with Trent. We took his Raptor out for a ride, which is cool. We should talk about that, but your buddy landed a little bit north of here in like a little meadow, kind of settled in a canyon. What is the name of the rock stacks that you put there?
A cairn. Yeah, you've never seen people stack rocks?
And
it's annoying in like on hiking trails where people take what should be just a natural area and they stack them a bunch. Mm-hmm. So I'm in between on those. Like if I'm out hiking and people are doing those, I'm normally the guy that kicks them over. But
yeah, but it makes sense for like the reason why you guys do it.
Yeah,
which
so
I didn't really think about until today. I know you mentioned to them before when I flew with you, but I like watch you guys kind of set one up for that area.
Yeah.
So what does
that
signify?
So a lot of them, you know, it varies. A lot of times we'll either put a cairn on a rock that is, say it's exposed, it's like the tip of the iceberg,
mm-hmm.
but it's hard to see from the air. So if you stack more rocks on it, you can see it and know to avoid it.
Okay.
But on this one, it was kind of, that's our touchdown marker. So given that the hill kind of rolled off on the approach side, it's easy to short those and find yourself running into the front of a hill that comes up quicker than you think.
Yeah.
And it's also easy to float long. And that particular spot probably had, I don't know, 500 feet. It's pretty long. We had the room to give up, but having that marker there, you just have something to aim for.
And then what's the, like a textbook rule for discovering uncharted land, whatever you want to call it. You have to do a certain amount of low fly passovers and just kind of like scout the area. You're looking for rocks and ruts and trees. You're looking for everything, right?
Yeah. There's a lot to that. Honestly, like first obviously is understanding, you know, is this public land? Is it legal to land on this public land? Cause mm-hmm. some public like wilderness is no go. Wilderness study areas, all those are no go. And then even different like ranger districts for BLM can have weird rules. So you gotta like know what district you're in and if that's legal. But then from that point, it's kind of like this aerial assessment. If you don't have the chance to be on the ground and walk it out, like you kind of have to have this tool set of figuring out the feasibility of not only landing there, but taking back off and the approach and departure paths. And are you even able to make, you know, some inspection passes in a safe manner? So like the broad stroke idea is you do a couple high up passes, kind of looking for obstructions. Like, are there power lines in the way? What's my approach path? Where, you know, how can I go around? What's my intended center line? Where do I think I'm going to touch down? And you're basically taking note in your head of like, okay, there, you know, a lot of times out here, it's like, there's one sagebrush and I'm looking at that.
Yeah.
It's so easy to forget which one it is. But then you work your way down like to a mid-level and then low-level inspection passes. And a lot of times, if you have the ability, you will even drag them, basically do a touch and go, drag your tires on it and roll it just to see what the
like the soil is like.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's not always necessary, but if you're landing next to a lake and you're like, is it muddy?
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to get stuck in the mud. So sometimes you do that and sometimes you'll do it and you'll see your tire hits the ground and it doesn't spin at all. Cause it's just sliding on like, you know,
pull up
grease snot. Yeah. And then sometimes you'll touch and your tire starts flinging mud up into your wing and your prop and you're like, uh-oh, no.
Yeah.
And so get out before you're stuck. But yeah, so Brian had done all his passes, and it was a unique scenario that, you know, airplanes always, whenever possible, you should be taking off and landing facing into the wind,
mm-hmm.
because that wind creates lift that helps you take off and land slower. And when you're landing and taking off, like you want to, you know, start from a stop and come to a complete stop on landing. So, it's always better to land and take off into the wind. Now, this particular landing spot is sloped. So that day the wind was blowing uphill. And so then Brian basically was put in this position where he's like, do I land with a tailwind? Cause we shouldn't land with a tailwind. I want to land with a headwind. Mm-hmm. So he made the decision to fly down the canyon and land going downhill. And believe me, I've done the same thing and scared myself and been near doing what he did.
Yeah.
But I can tell you for sure, gravity is a much stronger force to have on your side than wind. So yeah, I will land with a tailwind going uphill every day of the week over landing downhill with a headwind.
Yeah. What do you think that threshold is? Like, obviously it depends. Well, that's not even a good question because it's going to depend on the slope, the terrain you're on, how much headwind, how your plane's loaded and everything like that. But you're constantly obviously maintaining your plane. You're loading it before every flight and everything. So you have to be like super sharp and on top of knowing all of the things that you've learned over the past 14 years of flying to be able to make those decisions relatively quickly too.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously you're going to have inspection passes and you're scouting the whole area, but I'm sure you've been in situations where you come in for an approach and there's a, what do you call it? Like a dropout or a, what is it?
Like a downdraft?
Downdraft, but like we had one coming into your
That downdraft or a sinker.
A sinker, that's what you called it.
Yeah, those are, yeah.
And then in that moment, sometimes you have to completely correct, change your course. Like, I mean, you're probably thinking about so much.
Yeah. And there's definitely a point where, you know, my strip here, I could go around. But I treat it as a no-go around because we're going into rising terrain. You know, the approach end or the landing end is 30 feet lower than right here at the top where my truck's parked. So it's steeper than it looks.
Yeah, it's pretty extreme.
So you know, if you elect to make a go around at a late point, you need to make an immediate positive rate of climb. Like a lot of times planes, it takes a second for them to build enough speed back up to start climbing. This one, you need to be climbing now.
Yeah.
And it could put you in a position where you're just basically hanging on the prop, climbing over houses into, you know, this mountain behind us. And if your engine so much as coughs in the least bit, you're done.
You're just going to stall and that's pretty much it.
Mm-hmm. So this one, I treat it like a no go around. So when it was giving us all, you know, that downdraft, you heard me back into the power and we landed kind of fast cause I was just trying to not hit the ground before I wanted to.
Yeah.
Whereas in other locations that probably would have just been a go around like, hey, I'm going to go back and get more stabilized on a different approach and see if I have a better shot the second time.
Yeah. It's crazy. Cause like all you're thinking about all that stuff and me not knowing anything. I'm just a passenger sitting there like filming. And I'm like, and I'm like hearing you talk to Brian about how the winds are and everything. And like, I mean, everything feels safe for the most part, like when I've flown with you, but
yeah, it is.
Yeah, it's crazy. Cause I'm just completely oblivious to it. I'm like, oh, this is really fun. And you're like, doing calculations like, okay, how am I going to land safely?
The scary part is there unfortunately are pilots that are taking the approach you had as a passenger, just blissfully unaware.
Just like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah. And I don't know where that problem stems from. I've had people ask me, they're like, if you fly planes, does that make you a better driver? And I'm like, no. I'm like, but I can tell you the people that are good drivers would make good pilots.
Yeah.
Because it's the people that pay attention and care. You know, because there's tons of people that just are in their car and they're not caring about if it's a smooth ride or making their passengers sick or if they're distracted on the phone and bouncing off the drunk bumps on both sides. Like if you're someone that cares about driving and you have like a finesse to it, you're going to make a great pilot. Yeah. And someone that thinks ahead and kind of like plans things through. If you're someone that like, you know, if you're the guy that forgets your phone at, you know, home 10 times a month, like you probably shouldn't go flying.
Where are my keys? Where's my wallet?
Yeah.
At?
If you're really forgetful and just kind of, and the clumsy people, like again, all of this you can overcome, but you got to be aware of it. So understanding our vulnerabilities and shortcomings, I think is a pretty big part of being a pilot.
Yeah. I think like meeting a lot of your friends who are pilots, that's pretty clear now. Like they're all relatively like similarly mannered. Like it seems like they're pretty sharp, intelligent people, like kind of like car guys. Most car guys who are like true car enthusiasts really know their stuff and kind of have appreciation for motors and mechanical stuff as a whole, they're generally obviously good drivers.
Yeah.
And then there's dudes who don't care about cars at all, which is kind of weird to me. Like most of my friends are into cars in some way, shape or form. But then those people who are not into it, they're just like running over curbs at Starbucks and stuff like that. So
yeah, it's weird to me. I just never been that guy. I think I'm just like, I'm into everything.
Yeah.
So anything I'm around, like I want to know more. I want to, and if I buy something, I take care of it. I've never been the guy that's like, oh, whatever, it's just a car. You're like, well, dude, it's your car. Treat it nice.
The only thing I mean, I'm the same way, but the only thing that I am a little more careless with, and I'm sure you can relate to this too, is camera gear.
You are careless with camera gear.
It's not even that I'm careless, but I look at all of this stuff, this equipment, my cameras and stuff as a tool.
100%, and I take care of my tools.
Yeah.
I mean, so here's the thing. It's not that I am the guy that's like back home, like dusting off my cameras every day and keeping them pristine. Yeah. I use them, but it's not like I hammer on them. I try to take care of it. I'm also the guy that, like, you got to remember for a long time, my job was flying high-end cinema cameras on this dodgy little toy helicopter I built in my garage.
Yeah.
And there was a very high probability at some point that something was going to fail and I would lose it. So you take care of it as much as you can, but understand that those, you know, they're tools and they do get damaged at times.
Yeah. And I wouldn't say I'm hard on camera gear and stuff like that. I mean, I've only ever broken like one camera, and it was because I had a shotgun mic on a body like that. It was a 5D Mark II at the time, and it was bouncing around in the back of my truck on the mic input, so it like snapped off in there.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's just me being kind of careless, but I'm not like going out of
You're
my
not
way
that bad.
To,
I'm just giving you shit.
I know, but it's at the end of the day, I do treat all of my stuff as tools, and they haven't failed me yet. I mean, we both use pro tools and they're weather sealed. So like today, just like an hour ago, we were out filming with your third gen Raptor, and I'm standing out there as you're ripping by me at like 90 miles an hour, dust flying. At one point you smashed through a puddle and I thought I was going to be soaked.
Dude, in the rearview mirror, I was like, I just gave him a bath. That was rad.
Hopefully that
you're
video,
riding home in the back, man.
Yeah. Hopefully the video turns out good. I mean, it was just like a quick vlog. It's already up if you're listening to this podcast, but I'm standing 20 feet from this puddle right on the side of this trail, and I'm zoomed in, so I feel like I'm in the action, and I'm trying to stay still. He smashes through this puddle like over some whoops, and I hear the water fly up, and I flinch. You can probably see it in the video, and I was like, oh, I'm waiting for it. I was waiting for like Splash Mountain to just like come down on top of
that's
me.
That's what it looked like from my truck. So
it's what I thought I was getting hit by it, but yeah, that's what you do with tools like this to create the type of content we create too. I mean, you're strapping cameras all over your plane.
Yeah.
I mean, you have some really cool setups. That's one of the coolest things about the Kit Fox. We get into Fly Today and you're like, oh, if you want to capture our audio for an Instagram story, just plug your phone into this thing. Or if you want to get audio for your main camera, plug this into here. And it's like everything is set up to capture content, which is obviously what I love because it's what we both do.
Yeah.
So how long have you been on YouTube, by the way?
I want to say I started posting like end of 2017. Really, it was 2018 was my first year.
Okay.
6 years? Six and change?
Yeah, six. I started in February of 16 is when I posted my first video. I was consuming a lot of stuff before then, but I guess what got you into that? Because obviously you knew how to run a camera. You're doing like essentially commercial shoots at that time. You're into the storytelling aspect of things. Were you watching a lot of pilot content and things like that?
So it's a weird string of events that got me there. Basically, you know, I told you I used to make ski videos. Like I liked making films. Well, and action sports was my kind of thing.
That's what I did first too.
Yeah.
I started using a camera to film me and my buddy skiing.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. So similar background. And through the transition of turning into this, you know, pilot of unmanned aircraft in the film industry, I went from someone that was, you know, a filmmaker, whether it was a good filmmaker or not, to just a drone driver. I just, you know, and with the way I fly line of sight, I don't even look at what we're shooting. I'm looking at the aircraft in the air.
Yeah.
So even though I was working on these huge projects, movies, TV shows, commercials, all that stuff, I really didn't have any say. So I wasn't being creative. You know, I kind of lost that side of things. So I, when I got into flying, I would just go out and make little like montages of flying.
Okay.
And then I found that when I first was, you know, a pilot, I was so into flying that like if I wasn't flying, I would end up on YouTube, even though I wasn't really a YouTube guy.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd try to look up flying stuff and there just wasn't anything worth a damn. They were all cheesy, horrible videos. They didn't really showcase it well. So I originally started posting those kind of montage, like action sports style, like edits.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I stumbled on, do you know who Tucker Gott is? He's a paramotor guy.
Yeah, out of New Jersey.
Mm-hmm. I clicked on one of his videos and I sat there and I watched like a 20-minute video, which I had never done. My attention span was like 2 minutes. And I was like, why did I just stick around? What happened? And I was like, it's the context of this kid talking to me and I feel like I'm just hanging out with him.
As he's flying through the air.
Yeah. And I'm like, what is, this is so weird to me. And I'm like, kind of thinking, okay, so he vlogs. I'm like, I'm flying and doing similar stuff that I think people would be interested in.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, I obviously have all the gear in the world. And you know, if I'm not on a drone shoot, I had a lot of free time. I had nothing else to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, I should just give it a shot. I'm going to start posting a video a week and just see if it goes anywhere. And I figured, you know, the worst case scenario, I wasted some time, but I'll at least have a cool archive that I can look back on and remember what I was doing at this point in my life.
Yeah.
Best case, I was like, yeah, it could open some doors. You know, maybe I'll meet some people that could lead to whatever's next in life. So yeah. I, at no point did I expect for it to be like, you know, my main source of income.
That's so crazy because that's like, whenever I'm a guest on a podcast, people always start like, oh, what got you into YouTube? Which I hate because I tell the same story over and over again, but that's like almost to a T my story too.
Yeah.
Like I was traveling at the time and moving from city to city at my normal corporate job. And I was watching a lot of like vloggers at the time, Peter McKinnon, Casey Neistat, guys like that. And I was like, my life's kind of interesting. I'm not going to do it better than these guys that I'm watching, but like I have other hobbies that these guys don't talk about. I was like, I know how to run a camera from all the skiing videos I made. It's like, I'm just going to challenge myself to make a video for a week for one full year and just see how it goes.
Yeah.
And then after that year, like I got like 1500 subscribers, all friends and family of like people who are in my videos.
Yeah.
Like, I remember that time we went to the bar in Philadelphia, like, check this out. We're all just being dumb drunks.
You're like, I can grow my subscribership as long as I just film everyone yeah. and they'll all subscribe.
Dude. And that's how my channel started early on. Like, it was all vlogs with some of my best friends from back home in Pennsylvania. And like, they became characters in my videos. And like, still to this day, there's people who, I mean, I started this podcast with those friends like years ago and people are like, oh man, I wish you would hang out with Rhodes again. Cause like, I love, he's funny and whatever. So, but yeah, never in a million years thought I could make it a career. I didn't really realize like people were making money on YouTube at the time.
Yeah.
I was just, I mean, like,
I guess I did realize that. I just also realized the likelihood of that, of me being able to do that.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, there are so many people that have, you know, all these interesting stories and are probably more interesting than me,
mm-hmm.
That can probably do this better. But I think that's the big thing I learned was like, don't let that stop you. Like, just tell your story, have fun with it, all that. But yeah, it was so funny, dude. The first AdSense check I got was like $100 and my buddies were with me. I think we were like out at dinner or something. I'm like, dude, no way. YouTube just paid me and we're all like, what? I'm like, drinks on me, guys. Like, I got $100. It was like, it was awesome. I remember thinking at one point too, what if I could make enough that it would cover my car payment or, you know, or my mortgage.
It's like your hobby is now paying for other hobbies.
Yeah.
Which is incredible, really.
Yeah. It's a crazy thing. And, you know, again, working from action sports industry and I edited professionally for a while in the film industry and then being freelance on the filming side of things. Like, I've worked my way through for the film world a bit and I kind of feel like YouTube is just the filmmaking cheat code. Like, there is no other way that you can, you know, make whatever kind of films you want about whatever you want, whenever you want, however you want, and still make money off of it.
Yeah. 'Cause
even the best directors of any feature film or commercial have some suit and tie behind them telling them what they have to do.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty cool the freedom it allows.
Yeah, that's one thing about my channel is like most people will start a YouTube channel whether they're in it for the money or not. Like, obviously you were passionate about just filmmaking and telling stories, so that is why you saw success. That is why most people see success. A lot of people who do it for money will generally start make a lot of wrong decisions and then just get burnt out because they don't actually enjoy the process of the whole thing.
Yeah, they're in it for the wrong reasons.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that I'm just lucky. I kind of like fell into it. Like I just happened to be passionate about carrying around a camera and like filming dumb stuff, but yeah, never expected it to turn into like what it is now.
Yeah.
What would you give a new creator advice on? Because like, I mean, what we just talked about is obviously good advice for anyone who's trying to get into the creator space. I'm sure just like me, people come up to you all the time like, oh yeah, I had an idea for a YouTube channel. Like, and they like, don't know what goes into it.
Yeah.
Like nowadays I would say that you can't really go into YouTube and only expect to make money off of the AdSense. Like you really have to be way more business minded now than you did 5-10 years ago.
Yeah. And see, I had never, I've heard stories back in the day where people would make good income off AdSense. And I'm sure there's others that still do, but you just, the amount of views you have to get. And for people that aren't in the YouTube world, there's a metric called CPM, cost per milli, right? Mm-hmm. And it's basically the dollar amount per 1,000 views that you get. And most people it's like, what, 20 cents or something?
Yeah. And it varies per country. It depends on the type of content you make and the advertisers that are choosing to advertise on your videos. There was a time like when I started, I remember when I got my first like YouTube check, it was the same thing. I don't even think it was $100. So it might've been like $15. I remember where I was too. I was in Boston out with some friends and I was like, yo, look, I just made like $1.30 in like the past day. And they're like, what? And I was like, I don't know. Like I've never experienced this
before.
It's
just churning, man. The machine's working.
But nowadays, like again, there are people crushing it on YouTube with views and stuff like that. But the level for entry as far as like being able to turn a profit and not even a profit, but to make any money, it's way harder to get to that threshold than ever before. Like the parameters for joining the creator program were way lower when I was able to join.
Yeah.
Like I joined in probably 2016, 2017 maybe. But now you have to have more watch hours, so on and so forth, which makes sense. But the ad revenue, at least from all the creator friends that I've talked to across the board, have just gone way down, basically stemming from that PewDiePie incident.
Yeah.
Which is everyone called the adpocalypse. So something happened with a big creator and he did something wrong. And advertisers saw that because he's so huge and they were like, we don't want to run ads on YouTube anymore. And then everything just kind of went poof and plummeted after that.
Yeah.
So
it is I've heard of this back in the day and it is a scary thing because it's so out of our control. You know, as creators, we're kind of, if you are making your primary income on AdSense, you're at the mercy of the algorithm and the payout schedule and everything.
Yeah.
And the advertisers and how much buy-in they want to do. I think I said the CPM thing wrong. I think it's like averages $2 per 1,000 views. Does that sound right?
I don't even know. Like I could pull up on my phone and like look at it. But like I said, it's different every country.
Every single person too. It's all on your demographics and your audience and everything. So
there's some countries, like I don't even really look at it all that much, but most of my audience is United States, Canada, UK. But every once in a while, there's a random country somewhere in the world where their CPM's like $11.
Yeah.
I'm like, shit, I got to make a video about that country. Dude, so those people
also
watch.
People that make like financial videos as far as like investing and stuff.
Oh yeah.
I think because their audience is so eager to invest and spend money the way that they say, like the ads that roll on theirs turn to conversions much higher rates than other channels. So
I believe that.
Whereas I think if you're, I don't know what, like what kind of videos is like you just click on and then never pay attention to. So I think the more targeted audiences of people that are consumers are where the higher CPMs are.
Yeah. That makes sense too.
But going back to your original question, what advice would I have? First advice would be don't take my advice. Cause I am no expert on YouTube.
I'm still
learning, but I think that we kind of brushed on it. Like if you're going to get into this, get into it because you love doing it,
mm-hmm.
because you enjoy the process and you have fun making content. Do not do it because you want to make money.
Yeah.
You can do it because you want to have something to look back on. And like I said, maybe it opens doors, but if you don't enjoy the process and you wouldn't do it knowing you'll never make money,
mm-hmm.
then don't do it. Because I just, every time I see someone that starts it for the sake of just making money, it's like the authenticity is not there.
Definitely not. And that's a main component that a lot of people miss out on going into the idea of creating a YouTube channel like that. They're just like, oh yeah, I want to, even people who just want to grow an audience and like become an influencer and to become famous. Like you and I both started making videos because we wanted to remember shit with our friends. Like,
yeah,
you want to go set up an urban rail and like go slide this and do a bunch of cool shit. Like I want to look back on that in a couple of years and be like, oh, that was fun times.
Yeah.
And then
the influencer side or the,
I hate that word.
I know. I don't even like calling it that. But even the idea of being recognized or famous is of zero value to me. If anything, it's super uncomfortable for me. And it's weird because it's this strange dynamic that like from a base level, it's the largest compliment you could ever get is that someone watches you and feels like they know you and they like you enough that they want to come talk to you and you get recognized. And it's just a weird dynamic though, because I'm not the guy that like wants that or blossoms in that environment. But at the same time, like I said, it's the biggest compliment. So I'm not about to like ignore someone. Like I'm going to stop and take all the time to talk to them, because if I went out of my way to talk to someone that I was excited to see, like it would make my freaking day if they talked to me. So,
yeah, I mean, that was something that was hard for me to like get a grasp on, like, cause originally like it's going to start off with just internet hate. And that's a whole hurdle to get over in
itself.
That's
another thing. If you've got thin skin, don't do it. And just don't read comments, probably.
Yeah, don't read comments. I read every freaking comment.
Do you?
On everything I post, yeah.
No way.
Yeah, still to this day, I read everything.
I can't. And also, like, my audience is amazing. I have such good support, and it's overwhelmingly positive. It's very rare that I get any hate, but the freaking negativity bias, dude.
Oh man, there's so much.
One negative comment's worth like 20 good comments, and then you'll just stew on it. And I'm someone that like, I don't care. Yeah. I don't need to, but it still gets you. And you're like, fuck. But I just hit a point. There was when my channel was, you know, right now I'll say I'm in a lull. Yeah.
I'm in between views.
I'm
in between views.
But there was a time when it was, you know, getting more views, more traffic than it's getting now. And it was like the comments were rolling in like, dude, it would be a full-time job. Because if you reply to a comment too, then they're going to reply back. And then all of a sudden you have like a miniature conversation. And it's like, say a video gets 1,000 comments.
Yeah.
If I got 1,000 texts in a day, like I'm going to have an anxiety attack.
Yeah.
And so, it used to be a guilt thing. And I finally was just like, I can't like just put, don't, you know. Luckily, I think the larger a channel gets, the more understandable it is that people don't reply. You know, really, sure. Startup channels, I think if someone doesn't reply to a comment, it kind of feels like you're being ignored. But I think most people understand once channels get a little bigger, it's just too much. But
yeah,
I do actually try when I, you know, if I'm posting and I'm around my computer, I try to sit there and reply to comments. But it's there's a lot that I don't see.
Yeah, that's one thing that I'm kind of conscious of. Like when I post a video, I want to be kind of active on my own video for at least the first hour maybe that it goes live. Like for the people who are there watching, again, I still read a lot of comments and I try to reply to any that I can answer a question. I can help someone out. I can just simply say thank you. A lot of times it goes too far and they keep asking questions and at some point you just have to ignore it. Like,
I know it sucks. I'm busy. I feel so bad. It's a huge compliment that people, like us and respect us enough to want to engage with us.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm so thankful for everything. Yeah. It's crazy.
But the weirdest, so like going back to my thing that I being recognized or having any sort of fame has never been a driving force for me. Mm-hmm. For the most part, I'm a small fish in the whole creator space. So it's not a problem. It's very rare if I get recognized. Now, in the flying world, that's a smaller space. And all of a sudden, it's like I'm a little bit bigger of a fish. And so that there's that air show at EAA Oshkosh in Wisconsin, the world's biggest air show. And that is, it's weird, dude. Like
you're like a celebrity there because it's your people.
It is. I'm way outside of my comfort zone in that. And again, it's like, I'm a fairly social person. I'm good. I can chat with anyone, but like, it can be exhausting, dude, like a full day. And like I said, if someone wants to talk to me, I'm going to take the time and I'm going to talk to them.
Yeah.
But God, by the end of that week, you're like, man, I need a break. I need to go bug out in the wilderness and not see anyone for like 3 weeks.
I know exactly how you feel, because like it's the first hurdle of like dealing with internet hate and trying to just be a good person and respond to people who are watching your videos, because without them, we wouldn't be able to do what we do.
100%.
And then when it comes to the in-person interaction, I don't get recognized like a ton, but more like, obviously it's not something I ever expected.
No.
So like just before I came up here yesterday, I'm sitting in a coffee shop parking lot and a dude drives by. He's like, I recognize that truck. I was like, oh, what's up, man? And we just like chatted for a couple minutes about whatever. He's like, yeah, used to watch all of this stuff, whatever. And it's cool. And I, like you said, I will waste time that I don't have to talk to those people, because that is super important to me.
Yeah.
But then when I go to Overland Expo in Flagstaff or Mountain West or Pacific Northwest, like I'm going there to support the companies who support me, because that goes back to the business talk. Like AdSense sucks. Without the people who sponsor content and help me out, I wouldn't be able to do it.
Yeah.
So I'm going there to support them, but I'm also going there to interact with the people who watch what I do all the time. And man, after 3 days of talking to 100 or possibly hundreds of people, and you're having like, it's not just like, hey, you want to grab a picture? Sure. It's like full blown conversations, asking questions. I'm sure people ask you about your plane. Yeah. Why do you run those tires?
And they're good questions, and it's like, they're engaging, and I try to be engaged to all of them, but yeah. It's taxing.
By the end of it, like I always say, I'm a pretty introverted person. I feel like most people in the creator space generally are, if you're a vlogger.
Probably. Yeah. It's a pretty isolating job too. You're a super, super social person, aside from being in a channel that has like, it's a group mentality, it's going to be isolating.
Yeah. So then when you have one of those weekends and you're meeting a bunch of people who watch your content, dude, it is draining after that. I love it. Don't get me wrong. And if you ever see me in public, please come up and say hi to me. I don't like when like someone will recognize you from across the bar and they're just like stare at you.
You can feel it.
And they're like looking at their phone and they're like pointing to their friend. They're like, look.
And I know what it is too. A lot of times too, like you see someone and you're like, I know that guy. What's his name? I remember he's the guy on YouTube. You can't remember his name. And I see that a lot. And then people that are like, are you? And I'm like, probably. Unless someone looks like me, it might be. But
I always like try to play dumb, because you don't want to be like, oh yeah, it's me.
Anyone knows who you are. Yeah. Never do that.
But I get that a lot too. Like, you... like, I recognize your vehicles. Like, is it Talon? I'm like, yeah, hey. Yeah. It's so awkward. It's not a normal human interaction.
It is strange, but yeah, I'm with you though. If you ever see me like him, come say hi. You have to.
Yeah.
Come on. Like, normally what happens too, if someone watches our content regularly, that means they share similar interests, and there's that parasocial relationship that they feel like they know us and that we're friends.
Yeah.
There's a high likelihood that if I did know them, we would be friends.
Exactly.
So come say hi. Like, we share similar interests. Like, come say hi. It doesn't mean I'm, you know, don't ask the entire day of us, but come say what's up, shake our hand. Like, that's absolutely expected. So
for sure. I've only ever had like maybe 3 or 4 interactions with people who watch my videos that was like relatively unpleasant, whether it's like they're asking too much personal stuff that I purposely don't put online or whatever it may be. But overwhelmingly, the majority of the time, it's great interactions. And like you said, I probably really like the people who watch my videos. Yeah. I know I do.
Yeah.
But in person, it's like, dude, we could be friends. Like, let's go hit a trail, go camp or
something.
That's
what's funny with me. There's certain people that they come up and they say hi in a way that I'm like, that's the same way I'd say what's up. I'm like, what are you doing? You want to go get a beer or something?
Yeah.
Like, are we friends now?
Yeah.
But,
do you get hit up on social media like that? Like when I posted I was in Reno, I feel bad not responding to these messages, but they're like, oh, dude, if you're in Reno, swing by. Like, I can show you a trail, or we're cooking steaks, we're having drinks at my house. And I'm just like, I appreciate it so much, but it's so out of my wheelhouse.
Dude, like, yeah, it's... And so I have all these open offers to, like, cabins to stay at up in Idaho and throughout, like in Alaska and all this stuff. And it's always like, yeah, I'll hit you up if I ever come into town. But it's like, now that list has gotten so long, I probably should have like made it like a note of it all. And
yeah.
I forget. So then if I end up somewhere and I post a story or a reel or something, and then the people are writing, hey, what the heck? I'm like, oh, I totally forgot, man. And it's not anything against them. And also most of my stuff, it's like, I don't know. I don't, you're better at the nomadic thing of just showing up with no real plans and being there. Normally when I'm somewhere, it's like, I've got something to do and I'm moving on to the next.
Yeah.
So it's harder to find time to do that. And a lot of times I kind of avoid, posting when I'm somewhere until afterwards.
Yeah.
Just because I'm scared
fair.
Of that.
I'm sure since we're so on the same page with like all these interactions with people and stuff like that, have you become friends with, and like pretty close friends with someone who watches your videos?
Yeah.
Just like a straight up fan, not a creator, don't have anything in common other than like they like to fly or they like to fly fish or whatever.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a good friend of mine, Ryan Greenhall, helped. I mean, I would not have this place out here if it wasn't for him. He like just showed up out at the Stead Airport and was like, "Hey man, I watch your videos." I'm like, "Cool." He's like, "I'm an electrician." I'm like, "Oh, awesome. Maybe you could give me a quote for wiring my house." He's like, "I don't really do that kind of electrical." Turns out he's like got one of the largest commercial electric companies in Nevada. He's like a bigwig, but you'd never know. Nicest guy in the world. And like, he saw me coming into building a home, owner building with zero construction experience on this like crazy short timeline. And he's like, "This kid needs help." So thank God he
let
came
me
out
offer
here.
Yeah, my services.
Like, "Dude, you're in trouble. Let me come help you." So,
yeah. I've actually become like pretty tight friends, like where I'll give them my phone number after like meeting them a few times. And like, I'm tight with a lot of people who really just knew me from YouTube. And a lot of times it's just like straight up friendship. Like, we're either skiing together or camping or whatever it may be. Sometimes it's like you said, like someone is like, "Hey, I really enjoy your content. I see you're doing this thing. I can help with that." And they're like offering like a service or whatever it may be. And like, those are, I feel indebted to them, but they feel indebted to us. They're like, "Oh dude, I love your content. Like, let me help you."
Yeah.
I meet people who help me in like the camera world and the vehicle world. And it's so fulfilling compared to my old job.
Yeah. And that's again, going back to one of my driving forces was really the networking capacity that you're like putting yourself out there. I mean, I feel like if you do it in an authentic way, like you could build authentic relationships and open doors in the future by putting yourself out there. I know it's intimidating and it's a lot to just share your life like this.
Oh yeah.
Like, it's not easy. And there's parts of it that, you know, you kind of get put under a magnifying glass, which isn't always great. And it's like the other thing too, I think, there's probably an assumption that if you're posting videos about your life, that you're saying that you have it all figured out.
Yeah.
And that's not the truth.
No.
It's like, "Hey, this is just my story. Come along for the ride. Like, I'm figuring it out on the fly. Don't assume that I'm any smarter than anyone else out there."
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't know why that people just assume like, "Oh, if you're making a video on this, you must be, you know, the all-knowing person." Like, no, dude, I thought it was interesting, so I wanted to make a video about it.
That comes with numbers too. Like, I noticed that my audience, or like the ones who still watch to this day that started watching from the beginning, they saw me from the infancy of my channel. So they're like, "Oh, this dude's just posting about stuff that he likes. Obviously he's not an expert. He doesn't have a big number next to his name that says he would be." Some people will come across your channel about flying and they're like, "Oh, this guy's got a bunch of followers, so he must be like an expert at this."
Yeah.
And like, dude, still to this day, whenever I'm making videos, I can't tell you how many times I'm saying things like, "This is just my opinion. There's other content out there about this thing that I'm talking about." Like,
yeah.
I make it very clear. I'm not a professional. I'm a fucking idiot, if we're being honest.
Yeah, like, dude, again, don't trust a thing I say. That's the first piece of advice, but yeah. It is, it's a weird dynamic in that sense that like you said, if you have a big audience, all of a sudden people assume that you know everything and you're also unable to make any mistakes. That's what like,
oh yeah.
Creators that just get burned on the cross for making just an honest, you're like, dude, anyone would have made that mistake. Let them be.
And I like sharing my mistakes from time to time. But when I share my mistakes, like if something happens in a video, I fucked up, I am going to show people what I did. Like, you have to go into so much detail, because if you show your mess up on video, people are going to hound you, whether they like you or not. They're like, "Oh, you should have done this, should have done that. Haven't you heard about
this
thing?"
I know all the things I should have done too.
Yeah. It's like mistakes happen. Yeah, and dude, like, that's why sometimes I'm reluctant. Like, I'll hesitate before I'm like, okay, am I going to include this in a video?
Yeah.
Because I know I'm going to get shit talked, and it's like most of the time I will put it in the video, but yeah, it's hard. It, like you said, your life is under a microscope because we did it to ourselves, but.
And the vast majority of, I think, our audiences get that. You know, again, it, yeah, it feels like what I, you know, again, going way back, I never watched YouTube. Now I do. You know, I'll watch episodic TV shows, but I don't have broadcast television, and I don't have a lot of time to watch anything. So when I do, it's kind of like you go on to keep up with your friends.
Yeah.
And some of them are, I'm watching you, who I actually know. Other ones I'm watching, like, you know, MKHB. I don't know him, but he's personable. He seems cool, and he's super knowledgeable. So you watch him, but it's like you're keeping up with your friend that's informing you on certain stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, most of the viewers, I think, look at you like a friend, and they're going to be accepting of you even with mistakes. It's the ones that are the loud ones that are normally just, you know, in probably not in a great spot if they're making those kind of comments.
Yeah. That's what, when it comes to working with brands as a content creator, that's what a lot of people don't really understand. But when I choose to run a product on my truck, it's generally because I was a customer and this is what I wanted to use. Like, say my armor, I'm running C4 fabrication armor.
Yeah.
I'm going to buy this anyway. So do you want to work together? Cool. Yeah. And then when someone sees me and my product choices, it's not just, oh, that's Talon and he runs that. Like, they know everything about my life because they've watched so much of my content. They know why I'm choosing the things that I'm doing and like the reasoning behind a lot of my choices. So, and I'm not saying like, it's not just a simple marketing thing, but people are going to take what I say and the products that I choose to heart because they're hearing it from a friend essentially, as opposed to like a newspaper ad, a magazine ad, like anything like that. That's what a lot of companies don't truly understand about the power behind like creator marketing is that it's such a personal level. Like, yes, like you have big numbers and whatever, but it's way more than that. It's really tying the brands together more than anything else.
Yeah. So a good friend of mine, actually, I brought this up. He was like, you know, he's like, it's different though. When I watch a bumper ad on the start of a YouTube video, he's like, I don't care what it's about. I'm going to hit skip. He's like, and if it won't let me skip, I'm just turning the other way because I hate it so much. Yep. He's like, but if I watch, like he was referring to one of my videos, if I watch your video and you tell me about something, it's like a friend recommending something to me. And it's, that's worth way more.
100%.
But again, it has to be, this is where on our end that we have to, you know, there's accountability. Like, don't just say yes to brands that you don't believe in. Mm-hmm. Like, and you know, there's ones that I've worked with that were more because, you know, I got bills to pay too. Mm-hmm. Maybe it wasn't the best brand, but pretty much every brand I've ever worked with is a company that I believe in, and they make a product that I actually use or like.
For sure.
So it makes it easier to do that authentically. And then also know, you know, as someone on my audience, that I'm not just saying it because I'm being paid to say it. It's like again, if Ford paid me to tell everyone that the Raptor's the best truck out there, you don't need to pay me to tell you that. Yeah. Like, I will tell you that. And so would I say no to that? I'm like, hell no. I'd say, yeah, pay me whatever. I'll say it anyway.
Yeah, that stuff makes it so much easier.
Yeah, if it's products you're really, really passionate about and believe in and the brand sees value in you, that's where these relationships can be really cool.
Yeah. And that those type of relationships obviously supplement our income, like we've talked about throughout the podcast. But one thing about it is like how do I say this without sounding like, I don't know.
You're going to sound like it anyway. Man.
I know.
You already do.
It's, I don't know. Let's just, let's just say it. But it's like you said, like, I'm not going to promote something that I don't use all the time. Like, you guys see me talk about Hoist in my videos. It's a hydration, like just talking about it makes me feel like I'm pitching, but I'm not. Like I brought this up earlier. I was like, oh yeah, I drink this stuff. It's good for you.
Yeah.
And like they do sponsor a few videos on my channel throughout the year, but I legit drink this stuff. Like my fridge is full of it. I drink it almost every day at home. And it's not like a lot of people will see you promoting something like, oh, here's a drink. And they're like, oh, you're a shill. Like you're just doing this for money. And it's like
sell out.
For the most part, you can, at least when you're following a creator for a long time, you can probably tell. Like, if I'm shilling something, you can tell. If I'm like, I can't even think of a product that I would just like promote, but it's like,
I'm trying to think that I've probably, so NordVPN.
Yeah.
I don't use VPNs. I mean, I get the value of them, and I think there's plenty of use cases for using a VPN, but I don't regularly use one.
Yeah.
So I get the point of it. It's easy for me to say that, yeah, you know, if especially if you're traveling abroad and you want to be able to watch Netflix, I get a VPN. If you're doing sketchy shit, you probably, well, don't do that, but probably get a VPN. So like there's a use for it. I think that's probably a good product, but it's not fully authentic. It's not like some of the other stuff that I'll tell you, like that we both have Leathermans in our pockets.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Leatherman. I wish. Has, yeah. Come on. Where are you at? Because I freaking swear by that thing. Like I've got that Skeletool that I would rather lose my cell phone than that thing.
Yeah.
Like I feel so naked without it.
Yeah. Dude. And like,
so the amount that I have shouted that thing out, sold it to friends, all this stuff. And I'm like, you guys don't understand. It's life altering. You need this.
Yeah.
And,
I use this thing all the time.
Yeah.
And like people know that I carry stuff like this all the time. So if an opportunity ever came up and Leatherman was like, oh, we would love to like sponsor a video or something.
Yeah, you better. I would be so stoked.
I would almost make a joke out of it. I would be like, hey guys, Leatherman is actually now paying me to tell you about this, even though I've told you about it a million times before.
Joke's on Leatherman though, because they don't have to pay me.
I know. I love that, this. Oh, man.
Yeah, it's funny. You got the bigger one. But that's cool. It doesn't require a sheath.
Yeah, let's talk EDC for a little bit. I mean, we could stop the podcast whenever, but you're kind of into EDC. Did you find the Skeletool through Mike?
No.
Last Line of Defense?
No.
Okay. I thought we had that conversation.
No.
Before.
So when I got this, when we were doing the engine swap on my plane, when we were changing, basically it was a big overhaul. We put a new engine, whole new cowling, all new avionics, rewired the entire plane, new windshield. Like it was we busted ass, but it still took us 3 or 4 weeks.
That is a great tool to have for a plane like that.
Well, so the owner of Kit Fox, John, he has a big holster and brings his Leatherman around. And there's so many times that we're with something, I'm like, oh, I need that tool. And he's just like, flips it out and fixes whatever is in front of him. And I'm just like, finally, like, I'm like, I don't want to carry the big one. But then I found the Skeletool. Yeah. And so I ordered one because I normally carried a blade. Mm-hmm. It's like, I open boxes with it. Pretty much it.
Then, you're opening mail. That's what I do with like my EDC.
You can say you're doing a bunch of other stuff. Yeah, sure. Every once in a while, you know, it's put to better use. But the switching to the Skeletool took up about as much space as a blade. But then just having a screwdriver and pliers and a bottle opener. I'm like, I can't. There is not a single day in my life that I don't fix something that I would normally probably just walk by and say, oh, I should fix that sometime.
Yeah.
And so little problems get shut down before they turn into big problems because I have this.
That's I think one of the perfect multi-tools. The only reason I don't carry it is because the non-symmetry of it messes me.
With the on the plier side,
it's just it's
like you open it and you hold it. I don't know, for the people that are watching this,
I'm assuming anyone who's still watching knows what a Skeletool is already.
So there's one side that's like convex and the other side's concave. The convex side you should be putting up against your palm. If you go backwards, like nothing's right in the world.
It's weird.
Put a round peg through a square hole.
And then like I'm carrying the Leatherman Signal. I've talked about this in videos, I think, and it has the same tools as that, but pliers are a little bigger, blades a little bigger, different steel. It has a saw.
Oh, you can cut trees down.
Oh yeah. It's got a bottle opener, which
is a fire starter.
Yeah. So that's what I was getting to. It's got an awl, it's got a bit driver, whatever, bottle opener. And then the Signal is like, it's like their outdoor survival tool, whatever. It has a fire starter, like a flint on there, which is integrated into a whistle, like a super loud emergency whistle.
Save me a rape whistle.
Yeah. So in case you're, you know, getting touched out there.
Just for the rape whistle. That's what it is.
And then we got a little like sharpener for the blade and whatever. But
dude, send me an affiliate link.
Yeah. Hey, Leatherman, Amazon. Sign me up for
Amazon affiliate. Just send it to me. I'll buy one.
They do.
I'll try.
Yeah, that's right. They probably sell it. I think I bought this on Amazon, actually.
I bought mine on Amazon, and I've definitely shouted out in videos and put an affiliate link there.
Yeah.
So at least Amazon can give me a little kickback.
Yeah. Well, what else is in your EDC? Obviously, cell phone. Are you into EDC stuff? You're a dude. You probably are.
So I used to watch. That's how I first videos of yours I'd seen, and like McKinnon's and stuff. Like I nerd out on it.
Yeah.
Because it's not something that I guess I don't nerd out on it, but I think about it in weird ways, and I hate when you have too much crap on you. And I'm just like, I'm a minimalist. So like I live in the desert, got chapstick, got to have Burt's Bees. And then now all I carry is my cell phone, and I run that tiny little mag wallet on the back.
Keeping it simple.
And I just, that's as light as I can go.
No flashlight or anything?
No, my phone has one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have you tried carrying a pocket light before?
Yeah.
It's, I go back and forth. Like in the wintertime, like now, generally it gets dark early. Although the days are getting longer, it's already
It blows. Yeah. The other day when you were coming out here yesterday, I was like, oh my God, it's 6 and there's still like light in the sky.
Yeah.
Like, yes.
Yeah. It's great. But in the wintertime, I carry a pocket light, and dude, it's so handy. People think it's dumb, like especially if you're not into EDC and everyday carry pocket dumps, whatever. But man, it is so damn useful. Obviously, better than a iPhone camera. In the summertime, when I'm not out at night very often, I won't carry one. But oh, dude, it's one of my favorite things to carry right now.
Yeah, I have a pretty sweet headlamp that I keep in my truck, and like if I'm working on stuff mm-hmm. or doing pretty much anything at night, it's like that comes out. I keep one in the house and in my truck, and I actually probably have one in the plane. So
my girlfriend gives me shit because I wear them when we're camping. Yeah. I wear the ones that clip onto the brim of a hat.
Oh.
And I've got a bunch of them in my truck, and like when it's dark out, I'm in charge of cooking and cleaning up around camp and everything, so I'll just throw one on my hat, and she's like, you look like a fucking dork. And I'm like,
I wear
Shut
one.
Up,
it's like
dude.
A sideways flashlight.
Yeah,
it's made
yeah.
by Olight. It's a sick one. A friend of mine had it, and I was like, I need one of those. And I bought it. Funny thing, Olight has sent me an email before asking to sponsor a video, and I didn't do it. But I love their lights.
That's good. They're aggressive when it comes to creator marketing.
Yeah.
Very aggressive.
So that's the other thing. So sometimes brands make good products that I like and use, but their approach to marketing doesn't align. So
yeah.
The one other thing I do carry from time to time, and this is a new thing, I've been trying to carry a little field notebook and a pen.
I tried that before.
Yeah, and I don't know that it, you know, the idea is, you know, making notes or checklists on your phone is just not the same. And like, so if you carry it and you're always just staying on top of write something every day.
Yeah.
It helps you stay on top of things. You know, it might have helped a little bit, but I don't have it on me right now.
Yeah, I have tried it for the same thing, but man, I use the Notes app. I use two different Notes apps in my phone, and I use them frequently. Like, I'm obviously on social media on my phone a lot, like trying to stay in touch with people who watch and like everything we talked about, but most of my used apps are my Notes apps because I'm planning videos, I'm planning packing lists for different trips and things like that, jotting down notes of things I have to remember, and then also mapping applications. Like, again, this sounds like a plug. It's not a plug, but we both use Onyx Off-Road.
Yeah.
And, like, at night when I'm laying in bed, especially when I'm out on a trip like this, like, I'll go camp somewhere tonight. I'll just be scrolling around on a map. Like, okay, kind of planning my route for the next day and, like, seeing what's in the area. Like, maybe little offshoot trails that I can go check out and things like that. And because of that, I've always done that. I think because I grew up riding motorcycles. And you got to know roads like crazy when you're just riding around aimlessly. But I feel like my sense of direction is pretty good. And then yours, you got bird's eye view. So your sense of direction is like probably insane.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like that's one of my stronger points. I had a pretty good sense prior to flying. But yeah, flying makes it like you're way better at like understanding landmarks and stuff and kind of getting a sense of what direction's what. And
just eyesight in general. Like you're pointing out things when we're flying that. I like I'm actively looking around and you're like, you see those wild Mustangs down there? And I'm like, my eyesight's good. Dude, I'm still squinting. I'm like,
that
where
is
are they?
Yeah, that comes, I think that's just like an acquired thing. The more you're in the air, the better you get at identifying things that aren't normal and seeing motion. Like this is the thing, like I have never once seen a mountain lion in my life. So we had one sniffing our front door. I was out of flying and Haley saw it on our Ring camera and it's like a 200-pound mountain lion here.
That's scary.
And we have bobcats and skunks and coyotes and also I'm pretty sure there's wolves out here now, but I've never seen a mountain lion. And I would think I'm flying over all the terrain they're at, but my guess is that a mountain lion just if a plane's going by it just kind of hunkers down.
Yeah.
And I'm like, there's not a chance in hell you're gonna see that thing from the rock next to it.
They're stealthy.
So then like antelope, we got a ton of those out here. They're easy because they got a white butt and they're going 50, 60 miles an hour. They're screaming.
Jumping 12 feet in the air.
Like, you can't miss that. What's that thing moving over there? Yeah. So I think a lot of it's movement. So the horses, that's what I saw.
And you don't, I don't know what made me think of this, but you don't wear glasses or contacts, right?
I used to wear contacts. I got LASIK. I got lasers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Was that, did you have bad eyesight before you started flying?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I've heard, I forget where I heard
it didn't
this.
Make my, flying has not made my vision better.
Okay, well that's kind of what I was getting at. I heard somewhere that like if you are often staring at something at long distances, like right now I'm staring at a snow-capped mountain in the distance, which I do frequently, they say that that is good for kind of like refreshing your eyesight, because nowadays everyone's on a screen, on a computer, like a couple inches or feet away from your face.
Yeah.
So I don't know where I heard it, but they're like, if you often spend time looking at things at long distance, it's actually good for your eyesight. It kind of like recalibrates everything.
Well, so the eye's a muscle. Obviously, there's the lens in there that's moving so you can focus. And I know back in like, I want to say it was like a Vietnam era like book that soldiers were using to improve their vision, was like a training book that you could go through and it would tell you exercises to strengthen your vision.
Okay.
And a friend of mine's mom, she claims, I mean, she used to wear glasses and she doesn't wear glasses anymore. And she said it was just reading the book and doing practices. So
really, do you know what some of the exercises are?
No, but I would guarantee it's like, hold your hand in front of your face, look at your hand. Now focus on the background. Now focus back on your hand and like do it back and forth and work on that. But you're 100% right. If you spend all your time looking at something right in front of you, your eyes are going to get lazy on the far end and they're not going to be able to.
Yeah.
Have good far vision.
Right, so I'm not a complete idiot. I was shooting in the dark there, thinking like this sounds like a thing, right?
don't you know, trust anything you hear from me, but I think there's merit to that. I've heard know, stuff about that.
Okay, cool.
Do you think YouTube has changed you?
Ooh. I think yes. That's such a good question. Like, if you think about it from a base level, like YouTube aside, like you run into an old friend and there may be some beef or something, they're like, you change, bro. My answer to that would be like, yeah, dude, you're supposed to change. Humans are supposed to change. You're ever evolving and changing. Your interests change. The people you associate with change. So you're constantly changing. And if you're not, you're probably not doing something right in life. Yeah. I think you should always be adapting and changing. Now, when it comes to YouTube changing me, it's definitely, like you said earlier too, it's a huge learning experience. Like I don't know everything. You constantly have to be learning and adapting to make things work. So yes, YouTube changed me in the way that I'm way more business oriented than I've ever been before, because you have to be after a certain point. I've learned so much about cameras and things like that. I don't think it's changed my character, like my morals, the way I treat people or anything like that. I think it's all been relatively a positive change of just like personal growth, things I'm into and networking, people that I've met. Like, man, you could talk about that for a while.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I mean, probably along the same lines. I hadn't really thought of it till I asked you. I was just trying to get it right.
That's a really good question. I feel like we could do a whole nother podcast on just that.
You know, something, same thing. Like, if anything, I've grown in a way that I wouldn't think of myself as a super like self-confident or cocky or arrogant kind of guy, but it's helped me feel more comfortable in my own skin. Like being able to share myself authentically out there and see that people like me, you know, that helped. So maybe I've built a little confidence, hopefully not arrogance from that. The business side is unique. You know, I've basically been self-employed pretty much my entire adult life. You know, my company Copter Kids, I own, I run. I've never really had to, you know, report to anyone. The YouTube thing is a whole different beast in a way that, so Copter Kids, if a company calls and wants to hire us for a shoot and they're going to pay our rate, like if I'm free, I'm going.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy as that. Yeah. If I'm available, I'll go. The YouTube thing, there's no one that calls and asks if you're available to do it. You have to be self-motivated.
Yeah, and the second you're not, you become complacent.
And it's so easy to be lazy and to say, you know, I could make a video, but I don't know if this is a good enough topic, or I don't know if people would like this, and I'm not really feeling on my A game today, and there's 8 million excuses you can come up with. So it's been a shift for me learning to be self-motivated, with full transparency, these contracts I have with ads, their sponsors that require me to post, you know, a couple of videos a month, like that is super helpful to me, because if they weren't there, there's probably months that I'd be like, weather's not great. I can't do anything that's like that exciting. And people probably don't want to watch normal stuff. But again, what I click on, I watch normal stuff. I don't need to see like, you know, the craziest thing in the world every video. So
yeah,
the accountability, being self accountable, That's been a pretty big learning thing and growing thing that has changed me.
I think I fight with that a lot. Like the not being motivated to film something like today, I didn't know what I was going to do when I was going to wake up. I didn't know if you were going to go film or if I was going to come with or whatever, if I was going to go film my own video. So going into like just hanging out today, I was like, I should probably film this because we're going to be doing cool stuff. Like I wouldn't say a lot, but some of my audience definitely knows you. Maybe some of your audience might know me.
Yeah.
It's cool crossover. And I mean, we became friends for a while. So going into like filming something like today, I'm like, dude, I have no idea what we're going to film. Like it really just goes back to my roots of like me holding up a camera and showing you what we're doing for the day.
Yeah.
So, it's definitely very hard to stay self-motivated, like you said.
It's just, I've never been at a point in my life where you're like, I don't have to work today.
Yeah.
Any day. There's not a single day that I have to work,
but
I have to tell myself I should, you gotta do something, man.
And
that's what's such a shift from other, self-employment like things. Again, like
yeah.
a lot, like. I actually can't, short of being like just an artist, like say if you're just painting paintings to put in a gallery to hope they sell.
You could stop
not
painting.
Contract work. I'm not talking contract work.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you just got to go and put in the time and do it. And there's no guarantee. And you just got to love the process.
Yeah.
And then also once it does turn into work, it's like it feels less fun and exciting as it did at the start. So how do you keep motivated? How do you keep going? And there's some weird dynamics with YouTube that, again, that's been the growth portion, like internally for me, that I've learned a lot through that.
Yeah. It's, I think one of the biggest things that I miss from like structured life, like having a 9-to-5 job is having a routine. Like,
yeah.
And it's a double-edged sword. Like you should always be challenging yourself and always be changing, like I mentioned, but I struggled early on when I left my job and was working for myself because you have all this newfound freedom and it's like, oh shit, like I could just not do anything today and that is okay.
Yeah. I can do it tomorrow.
But that's a very slippery slope, obviously.
Oh.
So I do occasionally miss like the routine of things because you have not only job security, but like it's just kind of like a natural rhythm of life. So
dude, I miss clocking out.
And oh,
you're done.
And not for, yeah,
dude. And you could just be like, I don't have shit to do today. What do you got? And like, is there a single time that you can clock out and not think about YouTube and not think about something? Like, you've seen me. I've been a stress case. I've got obligations for this month that I'm behind on all of them.
Yeah.
And I've got all the wheels turning, but it's just, I don't know if I'm going to get there. So it's not like I like can just clock out and say, okay, no, don't worry. Like, it's just, it's all the time.
About a month ago, I properly clocked out and it was difficult. I went on a vacation for the first time, like first proper vacation where I don't bring cameras in 7 years of YouTube.
Oh, awesome.
And me and Ashley went to a resort in Mexico with my mom and stepdad. And, I brought my little Leica
Q3. Yeah, I saw the video. It was a good video.
Dude, my girlfriend would have murdered me if I filmed a video. No, she's actually cool with it, but she always pressures me. She's like, you need to take a break. And I'm like, yeah, but
yeah,
like I can't.
And dude, it's, there's so much of my stuff that I do that you're like, that's kind of my justification that I'm like, I can call this work.
Yeah.
So if I go on this trip, I can make it happen because I can call it work.
Yeah.
So we did that Baja trip in my truck and like the only way that I could make it pencil is like, I'll shoot some videos of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it does take away from, you know, those times that it's like, I find that one thing I have to do pretty regularly is like, make sure to go out of my way and take the plane out with no cameras, no, you know, just go fly because I still love flying.
Yeah.
But sometimes when you get in the thick of it, it's like, am I flying just to make content?
Yeah.
Because I don't want to be in that position. Like I want to make content because I'm doing cool stuff that I want to share with my friends.
For sure. So. It was difficult to find that balance too early on because I used to just have a camera in my hand rolling like almost all the time. And then the more like, I would say that I've never really felt like truly complete burnout. Like I feel definitely very stressed and aggravated at times, but it got to a point where I became so efficient with filming. Like, I know when the camera should be on because something exciting might happen or something informative or educational might be going on. But other than that, I'll put my camera down and really try to be in the moment, especially on trips like you're talking about, where it's like,
yeah,
it's a fun trip and you want to be there in the moment, but also you kind of have to film to make it make sense. Like, if you're leaving for a full week, you should be making a video, because otherwise someone else is making videos and you're falling behind.
Dude, and the other crazy thing, so from a flying standpoint, when there's a big group of us and we're out, you know, as a gaggle having fun, it can be a nuisance if I'm trying to pull a camera out and stop everyone and figure out, you know, what we're doing. And
same with off-roading.
Yeah, so I'm very, very cognizant of that, and I try to be as streamlined and out of the way as possible. But I must have something that I do that has been very accepted with my friends that makes it fun, and maybe it's them getting to watch the videos later that they enjoy.
Yeah.
But I can say I've hung with other pilots that are content creators, and God, it was annoying. I'm like, dude, like, every time we'd get to go somewhere, like, say we were flying in the Idaho backcountry, and we're like ready to leave wherever we're at. And we're in our planes. Hold on, I need a drone shot.
Yeah.
Like, okay, well, I guess I'll shut my plane down and I'll wait while he goes around, screws around. We've been sitting here for an hour. Why did he not do that? And so when you have someone that does it in a way that's like takes away from what you're doing, it just sucks. Yeah. So it's something you have to be aware of as a creator and make sure that you can still be in the moment. Don't take away from the moment for other people.
Right.
And let's just try to like capture it in a way that does it justice. You know, a lot of the stuff, it's like, I'm not, you know, scripting anything, but if something funny happens, like, better be sure that I'm going to be there and people are going to know the camera's on, because sometimes it riles them up. It's even better. And it's just like, we have more fun because we're screwing around with the camera, you know?
It's interesting that you bring that up, because I do the same thing with off-roading. Like, we're out in the mountains on a trip, and because of what you just talked about, I generally keep my circle of friends pretty small. Like, my friends that I camp with all the time, some of them are creators themselves. Others just like to camp, but they appreciate and understand what I'm doing when I'm doing it. So like, and like you said, I try not to be like, hold on, like, stop here, I'm going to run up the trail and set up my camera, or let me throw the drone up.
But you have to. It's just doing
sometimes,
it.
Sometimes,
you know, you got to know, like, be respectful of people's time, communicate.
Yeah.
And talk it through. And, you know, if there's some people that aren't into it, it's fine. You know, you guys can go ahead. But, you know, I think this would be a cool spot for me to get a shot of everyone. You guys cool with it? And normally they are.
Yeah.
So.
And like, a lot of that is probably because they like seeing the stuff too.
Yeah.
But there, man, there's some people that, like, friends of mine, I love them, but I don't camp with them much, because a lot of times I'm going out to camp to specifically film a video.
Yeah.
And I know that I can't film my best version of a video possible with that person along, because they're getting aggravated, because they just want to get to camp and set up, or there's just a lot of factors that go into it. So like, that's another reason why, like, I don't go out and camp with random people very often, because I do go out and camp without the camera on occasionally. For the most part, though, I will be recording. That's just our job. Just like you. Like, you go out and fly just to fly. I'll go out and camp just to camp. But a majority of the time, I am trying to capture stuff for the audience who wants to do it but can't do it themselves. So,
yeah. And I will tell you, I can't remember the last time I've went airplane camping without filming it. And part of it is because that content is my favorite to make. It's my favorite ones to look back on.
Yeah.
And it's easier because we actually set up camp and I have a second that I can shoot some pretty B-roll and tell a story and catch the moments that are my favorite part about camping. And it's not that invasive.
And you can turn your camera off then and actually enjoy being out there.
Yeah. And those are easy. They're fun videos. I'm proud of them. Like, it almost feels like a shame for me to go camping and forget my camera when I'm flying.
We should do a collab video like that. We've never really made like a collab video.
Yeah.
But like, we've filmed together occasionally, like doing the podcast. I've filmed some stuff on my channel, but if I'm ever out here, I should just go, like, you give me coordinates. You like, get your truck to this spot and just wait. I'll be there at 6 PM. I'll have like a fire going. That would be such a cool video.
100%. Yeah. We could do that easy.
Well,
there's so many good places out here too. And the good thing is I got the ultimate like machine to go on beer runs and stuff. You forgot something? Like, I'll be back in 15, man. Dude, even from the Idaho backcountry, that's the craziest part. We'll be at, Johnson Creek is this big grass strip that is pretty popular. It's like freaking glamping. this like perfect grass runway. It looks like a, you know, a golf course. And they have all these like developed campsites with fire rings and all that. They have free firewood. They got Wi-Fi. They got hot
free
showers.
Firewood. That's sick.
It's yeah. I mean, you should donate, you know, chip into yeah, them, yeah. But, that it's in the backcountry. I mean, I think it's the, I forget what they said the drive is. It's a long ways to get back there, but it's literally like a 15-minute flight to McCall. So it's like, we'll go land there, set up camp, and then be like, all right, beer run. And we turn around and go flying and get all our groceries for the weekend.
Are there any places like, I'm sure in Alaska there are like this, but are there places like up in Idaho where it's almost like a runway community, like an airport, not a fly-in community, but like you could go and pull your plane up to essentially a gas station, fuel up, go get beer, go get snacks, whatever it may be, and then fly out?
Kind of. So there's definitely a lot of strips back there with a bunch of cabins on them. And that's like, you know, airplanes are really the only access aside from like jet boats to get in and out.
Yeah.
But as far as like gas stations, there's not really that.
That question stems from watching a bunch of Tucker Gotts videos because he's like, oh, I need to get milk. I'm going to go land in this grass field behind a grocery store.
Yeah.
Get milk and fly home.
Yeah. I don't know. He's flying an ultralight and they have different legal, different restrictions as far as that kind of stuff, where they can land, how close they can get to things.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, in most of these northwestern states, aside from California, like it's legal to land on roads. So I can land on a highway and taxi up to a fuel pump and run in, like I'll do that, car gas stations.
Wait, what state is that?
California, you can't, but in Nevada, Utah, Idaho, Montana.
So if it's safe, you could go out to a road out here and land on the pavement?
Yeah.
Whoa.
I got friends out in Elko that like he'll land in his neighborhood on the road and give all the neighborhood kids rides. He'll just go and pick him up.
What?
And like, yeah, someone called the cops on him and the sheriff showed up and the sheriff was like, is there a problem here? He's like, no, I'm just giving rides. And the sheriff was like, good. I didn't want to do any paperwork. Have fun. And so,
dude, that's cool. I did not know that.
Yeah. So the weird thing, so Nevada, it's not clearly defined. So in the United States, with the lack of a regulation, that is a freedom, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the hard thing is, you know, without the definition, you could still have a sheriff that wants to, you know, give you a hard time. You're not going to end up with a citation, but he could still hassle you for
a bit. Like, oh, it's not registered as a motor vehicle or
pretty
whatever.
Sure you can't do this. We're going to have to hold you here. But
so it's a unwritten, well, there's no rule. There's nothing written about it.
Not in Nevada.
Okay. And again, as long as you're a respectful human, you're not doing shit dangerous.
And so, and then in California, there is a regulation that says you can't.
Okay.
And then up in Idaho, there's a regulation that says you can. So in Montana, I believe. I know a bunch of these states, it's legal. So it's an interesting thing. Obviously, Alaska, they do it regularly, you know?
Oh, yeah. Right? That's got to be so cool.
Hey, I got to run to the corner store. I'm taking the Super Cub. So
yeah. That'd be so awesome.
Yeah.
Well, man, sun is setting. It's getting colder here.
It is freezing cold.
We should probably close the hangar door, but is there anything else you want to talk about, tell people about?
No, man. Thank you for, you know, having me on this. Like I said, this is good practice because I want to start a podcast fully aviation related.
Yeah, man.
Gnarly stories. That's what that one would be about. But it's cool to just kind of get a second to just, you know, chat.
Yeah.
Because that's something I'm not comfortable with on YouTube, is too long a form and not like having some idea of what I'm doing. So walking into a podcast and just, you know, spitballing, it's fun.
It's just all off the cuff. And that, I mean, that's why I enjoy doing them. Hopefully you guys like this stuff. If you do, like I say in every episode, subscribe to the channel, listen on Spotify, do all that stuff.
Do it.
Because I would like to see it grow. Like if it doesn't grow, I'm just going to get more demotivated after every episode. And
yeah, it doesn't hurt. It doesn't cost a thing. Just hit the subscribe button.
But yeah, dude, I appreciate you doing the podcast with me and letting me hang out here. I parked my Kimbo in your driveway last night and it was great. I typically come out here every year now on my way to Tahoe, which is where I'm headed, by the way. I'm like, yo, are you available? Can we hang out? Can we do stuff?
Yeah. I'm glad it worked out.
Yeah, man. Well, where can people find you at?
Just on YouTube, Trent Palmer, and at Trenton Palmer on Instagram.
Sweet.
I don't have a TikTok.
I do, but I don't really use it much.
I know. I was like, when the app came out, I was like, this is just for little kids.
Yeah.
And then it's like, now there's funny stuff on there. My wife sends me stuff daily. And I'm like, but all the good ones flow over to Instagram, so I see them anyway.
Yeah.
So
that's a discussion for another time, because TikTok is killing YouTube.
Oh.
But anyway, yeah, go check out Trent on all his platforms. The video that I made here today is out already, so you can find that on my channel, and we'll maybe do this again next year, dude.
Yeah, cool. Sounds good.
Good hanging with you. Thank you guys for listening, and we will talk to you in the next one.